Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 509, titled The Death of Iris Chang. This is being recorded on May 1st of the year 2005. We're going to plunge right in and continue with examining the background of Iris Chang's investigations and the circumstances surrounding her death. Again, she allegedly committed suicide. Perhaps she actually pulled the trigger. Perhaps someone else did. But there is certainly a very disturbing indication that her stay at a psychiatric hospital in Louisville at the behest of a colonel, someone she'd gone to interview and of whom she was very afraid, may have somehow affected her death. There's the possibility, I think, here of mind control in a classical sense, or perhaps the manipulation of the cycle of antidepressant drugs, some of which can have a devastating effect on the personality if they are not properly administered and sustained. Note again that Iris Chang, with investigations like her landmark book, The Rape of Nanking, her investigations of the comfort women, Korean and Chinese sex slaves used by the Japanese Army in World War II, and most recently her investigation of the Bataan death marchers, the atrocities against them, and the use of some of those survivors as slave laborers for Japanese corporations. All of these things cut across Japanese power politics. Japan is an aggressive player with the United States in the Middle East and other places internationally. The history of Cold War covert operations, much of which were financed by the Japanese gold that had been stolen during World War II as part of Golden Lily, and in particular the Golden Lily vaults that had been stashed in the Philippines. We also took a look at the fact that the whole issue of compensation by Japan and its corporations of slave laborers cuts across the profound political and economic relationships between Japanese and American transnationals and allied political interests on both sides of the Pacific. We're going to take a look now at the book Gold Warriors, co-authored by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. The book is subtitled America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold. It was published in hardcover by Verso Books. This book was the focal point of For the Record programs 428, 446, 451, and 502. In For the Record program 446, we concluded the broadcast by taking a look at the death threats that had been directed at these authors as a result of their overlapping investigations of power politics and World War II history in the Pacific. In particular, investigations into the Marcos Gold, which also is inextricably linked with the question of Operation Golden Lily, the Japanese war loot, and the subjects that we're looking at here. That and other overlapping investigations, including the book Gold Warriors, resulted in serious death threats against the Seagraves, Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. And I want to note a major endorsement on the back of the book Gold Warriors, quote, "The Seagraves have uncovered one of the biggest secrets of the 20th century," unquote. That from Iris Chang, the late author of The Rape of Nanking. She wasn't the late author then. Now, again, Iris Chang was also receiving death threats and pressure from these same types of interests. It apparently affected her emotionally, but note again that the spin that was put on her death was, oh, she succumbed, you know, she was neurotic, she got too depressed. Well, she was facing the same thing the Seagraves are facing, and ask yourselves, first of all, whether what you're seeing here wouldn't affect you emotionally, but beyond that, whether perhaps it suggests that some of these, quote, suicides, unquote, of controversial investigative reporters need to be looked at in a much deeper way, because Iris Chang was convinced that the threats against her were external and not internal. In the author's note at the beginning of Gold Warriors, we read in a passage called Slaying the Messenger, and again, this book was endorsed by Iris Chang, who said the Seagraves have uncovered one of the last great secrets of the 20th century. "Many people told us this book was historically important and must be published, then warned us that if it were published, we'd be murdered. An Australian economist who read it said, 'I hope they let you live,'" unquote. He didn't have to explain who they were, skipping down. "We've been threatened with murder before. When we published the Sung Dynasty, we were warned by a senior CIA official that a hit team was being assembled in Taiwan to come murder us. He said, 'I'd take this very seriously if I were you.' We vanished for a year to an island off the coast of British Columbia. While we were gone, a Taiwan hit team arrived in San Francisco and shot dead the Chinese-American journalist Henry Liu. When we published the Marcos Dynasty, we expected trouble from the Marcos family and its cronies, but instead we were harassed by Washington. Others had investigated the Marcoses, but we were the first to show how the U.S. government was secretly involved with Marcos gold deals. We came under attack from the U.S. Treasury Department and its Internal Revenue Service, whose agents made threatening midnight phone calls to our elderly parents. Arriving in New York for an author tour, one of us was intercepted at JFK Airport, passport seized, and held incommunicado for 3 hours. Eventually, the passport was returned without a word of explanation. When we ran Freedom of Information queries to see what was behind it, we were grudgingly sent a copy of a telex message on which every word was blacked out, including the date. The justification given for this censorship was the need to protect government sources, which are above the law. During one harassing phone call from a U.S. Treasury agent, he said he was sitting in his office watching an interview we'd done for a Japanese TV network, an interview broadcast only in Japanese, which we'd never seen. After publishing The Yamato Dynasty, which briefly mentioned the discovery that is the basis for gold warriors, our phones and email were tapped. We know this because when one of us was in a European clinic briefly for a medical procedure, the head nurse reported that, quote, someone posing as your American doctor, unquote, had been on the phone asking questions. When a brief extract of this book was published in the South China Morning Post in August of 2001, several phone calls from the editors were cut off suddenly. Emails from the newspaper took 72 hours to reach us, while copies sent to an associate nearby arrived instantly. In recent months, we began to receive veiled death threats. What have we done to provoke murder? To borrow a phrase from Jean Ziegler, we are combating official amnesia, unquote. We live in dangerous times, like Germany in the 1930s, when anyone who makes inconvenient disclosures about hidden assets can be branded a terrorist or a traitor. A few months ago, three ex-ambassadors to Japan declared that former American POWs and civilian slave laborers suing giant Japanese corporations for compensation were tantamount to terrorists. Now, a CIA official says that leaks of classified information must be stopped, even if it is necessary, quote, to, quote, send SWAT teams into journalists' homes, unquote. Everybody's national security is a serious matter. We have no argument with that. But national security can be invoked to hide official corruption and conflict of interest. It's called tyranny. The only cure is openness and sunlight. In this book, we don't question whether President Truman did the right thing in keeping these war gold recoveries secret. That's for others to debate. What we point out is that total secrecy enabled corrupt people to abuse the resulting slush funds, and these abuses have multiplied like a cancer ever since. A global network of corruption has grown around the slush funds. Bureaucrats, politicians, spooks, and generals have become addicted to the black money. There are indications that a lot of this war gold has been siphoned off by America's far right under the guise of patriotism. The unintended consequences of Truman's decision have become a poisonous part of the world financial system, putting innocent people at hazard. Those people and institutions benefiting from this corruption will do everything possible to hide it, including murder. The only way to get rid of an illness is first to recognize what it is, but when the emperor goes crazy from syphilis of the brain, the first person to be tortured and burned at the stake is the doctor who made the diagnosis, slaying the messenger. Despite the best efforts of the American and Japanese governments to destroy, withhold, or lose documentation related to Golden Lily, we have accumulated thousands of documents, conducted thousands of hours of interviews, and we make all of these available to readers of this book on two compact discs, available from our website www.bowstring.net, so they can make up their own minds. We encourage others with knowledge of these events to come forward. When the top is corrupt, the truth will not come from the top. It will emerge in bits and pieces from people like Jean Ziegler and Christoph Meile, parenthetically, who exposed the holding of loot that was taken from Holocaust victims and maintained in Swiss banks for decades after the war. Beginning again, it'll emerge in bits and pieces from people like Jean Ziegler and Christoph Meile, who decided they had to, quote, do something. As a precaution, should anything odd happen, we've arranged for this book and all its documentation to be put up on the Internet at a number of sites. If we are murdered, readers will have no difficulty figuring out who they, unquote, were. Well, again, Iris Chang, whose endorsement was carried on the back of Gold Warriors, was dealing with the exact same they, unquote, that had been harassing the Seagraves and threatening the Seagraves. Now, again, just stop and ask, if you were facing what the Seagraves and Iris Chang were facing, do you think that might get you a little bit down emotionally? But again, note that Iris Chang was a tough and resilient person. She may have been subject to depression. A lot of people are. They don't all kill themselves. Most don't. And again, note her fears about Norton Psychiatric Hospital and her internment there and the colonel and the retribution, as well as the death threats she was subjected to. We're going to review some information that we covered in For the Record number 502, and this about the persecution of Norbert Schley, a civil rights attorney and assistant attorney general in the 1960s, who in his private practice had been representing clients who were attempting to redeem Japanese 57 bonds. These were very special Japanese government notes that were drawn against a secret slush fund, the M Fund, that was part of this clandestine operation post-World War II, Japanese war loot slush fund milieu that Iris Chang and the Seagraves were cutting across. Norbert Schley was attempting to redeem some of these bonds. They were only selectively redeemable. If you weren't part of the in-crowd and specially designated, then you were prosecuted for attempting to redeem a fraudulent bond. After a very, very insignificant individual, the late Barbara Jean Bravender Alu, was persecuted by the U.S. government at the apparent instigation of the Japanese government for trying to redeem 57s, thereby potentially shedding light on this financial post-World War II cesspool that grew around the looted Japanese wealth, wealth that the Japanese had accumulated from World War II. We read the following about Norbert Schley, again from Gold Warriors. By January of 1992, 16 offices of the Secret Service were said to be involved in the Alu sting. Mrs. Alu was too insignificant to justify such an expenditure of taxpayers' money, so the vigilantes looked for someone else to lynch. One possibility was Takahashi, a client of Schley's, to whom the 57s belonged, but when they broke into his Los Angeles apartment, it was empty and he was out of the country in hiding. Trophy hunting has become a feature of the American criminal justice system, and Takahashi was not famous, so he wasn't a proper trophy for an ambitious U.S. attorney. Norbert Schley, on the other hand, was sticking his nose into deep black secrets and alarming Tokyo, parenthetically, as was Iris Chang. His Thai profile made him a perfect target. One year earlier, Schley had written a memo about the M Fund. It wasn't meant for general circulation, but a copy was passed to U.S. government officials who became alarmed and angry. If they could snare Schley, all branches of the U.S. government would cooperate to stop his digging into the M Fund, and the LDP leadership in Tokyo would be indebted. How to snare him was the problem. Schley had never tried to negotiate a 57 in America, only in Japan, on behalf of clients legally entitled to have an attorney make inquiries. Furthermore, Schley had never accepted a penny from these clients, but Takahashi was so impatient to sell one of his 57s that he had taken several of them back from Schley and, without telling him, turned them over to Roger Hill to market. It was quite a stretch to argue that Schley had anything to do with the independent marketing of the 57s by Roger Hill. The government could try to get Schley indicted as a party to the conspiracy of Alu, Hansberry, and Hill because he happened to be Takahashi's attorney and was admittedly trying to negotiate other 57s in Japan. It would be absurd to assert that Schley was involved in the Tampa transaction, but that could be covered by a little sleight of hand, misdirecting the jury so it didn't notice. Finally, since Schley freely acknowledged the Japanese government regarded the 57s as counterfeit, it could be argued that he was admittedly marketing certificates he knew to be false. This dodged the crucial point, which Schley stated again and again, that he was convinced the Japanese government was lying to avoid payment. In sum, the case against Schley would depend on a trophy-hunting prosecutor, a compliant judge, a misdirected jury, a coordinated effort by Washington to block all Schley's efforts at discovery, denial by the court of leave for Schley to take depositions in Japan, intimidation of defense witnesses, and expert, unquote, prosecution witnesses brought in from Japan's Ministry of Finance and Dai-ichi Bank, who seem to have been coached to be evasive and to give false testimony. Astonished to be named a party to the Alu deal, of which he was not even aware, Schley found himself the subject of grand jury proceedings in Tampa and was indicted. Immediately, clients holding 57 scattered to avoid being drawn in or, if cornered, became so frightened that they offered to testify against Schley in return for immunity from prosecution. In court, the prosecution proved, unquote, the certificates were fake by bringing in two minor officials of Japan's Ministry of Finance and Dai-ichi Bank who had a vested interest in sticking to this story. Schley's defense countered, "Corrupt Japanese officials were now falsely claiming that these financial instruments were not genuine," unquote. However, Professor Lossier insisted they were genuine, as quoted earlier, quote, "The documents are so precisely in agreement in innumerable respects with the official published records of the government of Japan that, in my opinion, it is quite impossible for them or the certificates that resulted from them to have been the work of any counterfeiter," unquote. To demonstrate collusion between Tokyo and Washington, the defense attempted to locate any reports or documents showing covert payments by the U.S. government to the government of Japan or any political party in Japan from 1945 to the present. As we've seen, this has been confirmed by a number of sources, including former CIA officials and U.S. diplomats. But fighting for his life, Schley needed all the documentary evidence available. As a former Assistant Attorney General of the United States, he was certain he would find these documents. It was Schley's legal right to make such discoveries, but federal agencies flatly refused to comply. News stories about the M Fund and 57s obliged the court to order the CIA, the Secret Service, National Archives, and State Department to conduct a search of their databases. Given the intense secrecy surrounding the Black Eagle Trust, the 1951 peace treaty, the M Fund, and the disappearance of millions of documents concerning Japan, it would have been a great surprise if anything turned up. The jury was told that, quote, "Search of the records of the CIA, the Secret Service, and the National Archives did not disclose any relevant or material documents or information that substantiated that the CIA gave money to employees or officials of the Japanese government or any political party in Japan," unquote. The court record says, again quoting, "The government searched hundreds of files of CIA paper records dating back to 1948 for any documents that might indicate that payments were made by the CIA to either the Japanese government, the Liberal Democratic Party, or individual party members. They also conducted computer searches for Marquardt Fund, and the search did not discover any relevant or material documents or information," unquote. The jury was not told that acting CIA Director William O. Studemont had informed the New York Times in March 1995 that the CIA was not about to divulge information on the subject of payola to foreign governments and politicos. Studemont said the agency had an obligation to keep faith, unquote, with politicians who, again quoting, received legally authorized covert support from the United States. This statement actually confirms that such payments were made, and merely refuses to give details. Japanese politicians bribed with huge sums of money had to be protected, which was more important than justice in American courts. And again, we've talked about the abuse that Norbert Schley was subjected to during the course of his ordeal. Basically, just about every conceivable abuse of the legal system was undertaken in order to get his conviction. He finally was able to achieve virtually a complete exoneration, but it bankrupted him. It cost his defense, cost him $10 million, and ultimately he had a heart attack and died shortly thereafter. In commenting on his legal ordeal, skipping down the Seagraves Right. Other events unfolding in January of 1992 may have led directly to Schley's persecution. He wasn't the only target of M Fund stings. Also arrested was James P. Cena, a 17-year veteran of the U.S. Secret Service, the agency that also investigates counterfeiting for the Treasury Department. Cena had examined M-funded financial instruments in America and Japan, where he became convinced of the legitimacy of the 57s. He decided to sell some himself. He and Ian Yorkshire of Great Britain and Francis Chung of Hong Kong were all arrested for attempting to market 57s with a total face value of $50 billion. Abruptly and for no apparent reason, in November of 1995, the case against them was suddenly dismissed with prejudice, unquote, meaning the charges cannot be refiled. Nevertheless, prosecutors refused to return the 57s they had confiscated as evidence, calling them contraband, unquote. If counterfeit, why were they contraband? We were told by a Wall Street source that the Treasury is eager to get its hands on 57s and other supposedly counterfeit derivatives so they can negotiate them secretly. And again, in For the Record 502, we took a look at how Alexander Haig, acting with a letter of recommendation from the elder George Bush, the president at the time, was able to successfully negotiate a 57 on behalf of the Paraguayan government. The Seagraves go on to comment, in short, Haig had succeeded and the deal went down. But how could Haig negotiate a 57 in Miami, Washington, and Tokyo with discussions at the FBI, CIA, and with President Bush in the White House without being arrested and prosecuted like Norbert Schley? Federal agents always insisted it was illegal to negotiate one inside America or even to contemplate it. If all, quote, 57s are counterfeit, why did Haig succeed? If Haig's 57 was genuine, did he still do something illegal? Does the legitimacy of a Japanese dead instrument depend on your connections to the current occupant of the White House? Norbert Schley was drawn into the sting soon after Haig's Tokyo negotiation concluded. One of Takashita's conditions about ending Japan bashing may have been that Schley, who was asking so many embarrassing questions, must be silenced and removed from the field of play. Parenthetically, was something similar said about Iris Chang? Continuing, if so, Haig certainly would have reported this to President Bush, which could explain why Schley was then dragged into the Ah Lu case. There's a lesson here for investors, and parenthetically, I might add, investigative journalists, too. Financial instruments growing out of the Black Eagle Trust continue to float around the global market like magnetic mines left over from World War II that can blow up and sink any institution or individual that comes in contact with them. If some certificates are counterfeit while others are legitimate, investors and their attorneys have a right to inquire without fear of arrest or intimidation whether the documents they hold are real or fake, and not to be brushed off with falsehoods, especially when the issuing government has a history of evasiveness and it is strongly suspected of lying. When Washington demonstrates that it has a greater sense of responsibility to corrupt foreign politicians than it does to its own citizens, we may rightly ask whom it is really protecting. Washington's main concern has been to protect and preserve a system of secret financial collusion with Japan, which has worked to its satisfaction for over half a century, and to protect the careers and reputations of U.S. government officials involved in that collusion. In the end, how many billions went to Japanese politicians is less important than how much went into the pockets of American officials. As power corrupts, secret power corrupts secretly. And we're going to take a look now at what happened to a number of lawsuits that were filed on behalf of some of the slave laborers who had been forced to labor, not only on behalf of Japanese corporations inextricably linked with their American counterparts, but also on some of the Golden Lily facilities in which some of this looted wealth was stored, including and especially in the Philippines. Note the reference here in these lawsuits to the Bataan Death March survivors. That was what Iris Chang was working on at the time of her death. Returning to Gold Warriors. Since 1999, more than 30 lawsuits have been filed in California courts by survivors of the Bataan Death March and other POWs who were forced to provide slave labor for Japanese companies. They were focused in California because the state legislature had extended the period when such claims could be filed. The U.S. government then had the cases transferred to a federal court in San Francisco, where most of these suits were then rejected in September of 2000 by federal judge John Vaughn Walker. Judge Walker said they were barred by the terms of the 1951 peace treaty, the same stonewalling used by Tokyo and Washington. Hard as it may be to believe, the State Department argued on the side of Japanese corporations in these cases. Walker summed up his decision by stating that the San Francisco Peace Treaty had, quote, exchanged full compensation of plaintiffs for a future peace. History has vindicated the wisdom of that bargain. And again, more now about these lawsuits that had been filed and what it was that caused the deep sixings of these lawsuits, and it was the economic relationships between these Japanese corporations and their counterparts in the U.S. What we're going to take a look at here is some of the forces that conspired to deep six these various lawsuits that had been filed on behalf of former slave laborers for Japanese industry, including survivors of the Bataan Death March. One of the people involved here was Keiichi Miyazawa, a former finance minister and prime minister and a major player in this decades-long post-World War II concatenation. And note the links here between American diplomats and people connected with these Japanese corporations that were the focal point of the suits. If anyone knows the truth, Miyazawa does, but he isn't talking, nor is his son-in-law, Christopher J. LaFleur, a career U.S. Foreign Service officer who for years has been the most powerful diplomat at the American Embassy in Tokyo as Deputy Chief of Mission, or DCM. In 1986, the 38-year-old LeFleur was dispatched to Tokyo, ostensibly to negotiate the sale of the FSX fighter plane the same year Schley came to Tokyo to negotiate his client's 57s. Miyazawa, then Minister of Finance, was Japan's FSX negotiator under a cloud in the recruit scandal linked to the 57s and M-Fund monies. One unexpected outcome of the friendship that blossomed between LeFleur and Miyazawa was that LeFleur married Miyazawa's daughter. In September of 1997, LeFleur was made deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, called the de facto boss of the embassy. A few months later, in 1998, Miyazawa was back in the driver's seat as finance minister in the Obuchi cabinet. Like his earlier appointments to this job, Miyazawa was returned to office to practice damage control. According to Professor Lossier, this time Miyazawa was put back in as finance minister because a large number of 57s were coming due, documents that the LDP and the government of Japan could ill afford to redeem and therefore denounced as counterfeit. Lossier believes that Miyazawa was there to decide which of these IOUs would be honored and which wouldn't. During the same period, the U.S. Embassy's LeFleur was vocal in claiming that the 57s were fraudulent and arguing against victims' rights to sue Japanese corporations on the basis of the 1951 treaty negotiated by LeFleur's father-in-law. Not only LeFleur, but a string of ambassadors also showed conspicuous conflict of interest. Many people were troubled to learn that Ambassador Tom Foley's wife was a paid consultant to Sumitomo Heavy Industries, one of the primary targets of the POW lawsuits for slave labor. The State Department declared that it saw no conflict of interest in Mrs. Foley's job and the simultaneous appointment of her husband as ambassador to Japan. However, in that post, Foley vigorously denied the right of American POWs to sue Japanese corporations, including the one his wife worked for. After retiring as ambassador and returning to Washington, Foley openly became a paid lobbyist for Mitsubishi Corporation as a member of its advisory board on strategy. Mitsubishi was among the biggest employers of American slave labor during the war. Skipping down. The low point of this farce came in late September of 2001 when a letter appeared in the Washington Post written by three former ambassadors to Tokyo, Thomas Foley, Michael Armacost, and Fritz Mondale. The letter linked the claims of American POWs against Japan to the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. Quote, "Why would Congress consider passing the Rohrabacher bill, which could abrogate a treaty so fundamental to our security, at a time the President and his administration are trying hard to combat terrorism?" Skipping down. As a dissident State Department official quipped, "Sometimes it seems that Japan has two embassies working for them, ours and theirs." Unquote. And again, note the forces that blocked those suits. Note also what was happening as Iris Chang was dying. The bullet that took her life, whether actually administered by herself or whether done through some form of mind control or psychological manipulation, or whether the gun was actually fired by somebody else. Note, she died on Tuesday, November 9th of 2004. On Wednesday, none other than Arnold Schwarzenegger was in Japan to promote trade and tourism between Japan and California. This from the one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's website. Update from the governor's office, November 10th, 2004. Keeping his promise to sell California all over the world, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger arrived in Japan on Wednesday on a trade mission to promote California business, agriculture, and tourism. Was among the reasons that Iris Chang was sacrificed in order to, quote, sell California, unquote. Again, this was almost exactly the time she died. He arrived in Japan the day after her death. Rest in peace, Iris Chang. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 509, The Death of Iris Chang, being recorded on May 1st of 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.